Hello and welcome to the second episode of our very makeshift little What the Flick podcast here, which my kid thinks we should call What the Flick at Home.
I was thinking What the Flick in Exile, but you know.
Okay, that's good too. Yeah, anyway, I'm still Christy Lemire. And so Matt Atchity was here last week. Now he's out of town. Alonzo Duralli is back in town, so he's here with me. Hello.
Hello. It's a rotating cast, but at some point, like magic, the four of us will actually be back at this table.
Sometime. I don't know when. Anyway, so I'm really happy to see you.
Good to see you, as always.
So Matt is gone. You are here, but you were in Venice.
Yes.
I want to talk about Venice with you, the Venice Film Festival, real fast. But first of all, we need to start with breaking news.
Yes.
We have very sad breaking news, and that is that Burt Reynolds has died at age 82.
A legend. Sorry, I thought I had my phone off. My bad.
No, it's okay.
Yes, he apparently died of cardiac arrest. And, oh, how to explain to the kids how big a deal Burt Reynolds was back in the day?
It's hard to because, I mean, there are so many different ways to become a star now, right? And so many different kinds of stars.
Right.
But he seemed to embody, like, an all-American kind of sexy swagger that was so 70s. It was so... He was the embodiment of the decade.
Exactly. He was definitely the right guy in the right era. And it's funny. One of the first things I thought about was Ross McKelvey's documentary, Sherman's March. Do you know that one?
It rings a bell.
It was one of sort of the first kind of personal documentaries. And he's sort of like, you know, kind of going through the South, and it's about his love life and stuff. But at some point but Burt Reynolds is this sort of image he keeps encountering of this sort of like Southern man of the 70s. You know, he even like runs into a Burt Reynolds sort of impersonator who's waiting outside of a motel where Burt Reynolds is supposedly staying while filming a movie because he wants to like become his stand-in. Anyway, but just the idea of Burt Reynolds sort of permeates this movie, and you get this idea of how big he was for a good chunk of time there. Like he had this period where even his crappy movies made money. He was he was considered this like sex symbol. He was taken seriously as an actor. Like, you know, there was a whole controversy that he didn't get an Oscar nomination for Deliverance because he had done the centerfold of Cosmopolitan magazine, you know. So he's a fascinating, you know, and then there's the whole, like, there's the dinner theater in Florida, and then there was the hit sitcom and, you know, all kinds of things.
Yeah, I'm looking at this Hollywood Reporter obit, and it says he was Hollywood's top grossing star in every year from 1978 to 1982.
Wow.
And only Bing Crosby in the 40s had that kind of run. And also, it's amazing to think, though, despite the many films he is known for, Smokey and the Bandit, Cannonball Run, Deliverance, as you mentioned, and the whole era.
Longest Yard.
Right. There are so many movies that he almost made. Do you know this? Like the various parts he turned down, like very famous parts that he turned down.
Such as?
Such as John McClane.
No kidding.
Yes, in Die Hard. And he turned down Han Solo. And he turned down Garrett Breedlove in Terms of Endearment.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah, it's amazing. And also, apparently, Richard Gere's role in Pretty Woman.
Interesting.
And so it's amazing to think of how different some of these really iconic films would have been if an overpowering presence like Burt Reynolds had been in them.
So much of Hollywood history is a pivot of, you know, who almost got what role or decided not to take it or whatever. I have to give him points for doing Peter Bogdanovich's At Long Last Love, which is, you know, it was a flop at the time, and I think its reputation has been somewhat improving with a new director's cut that's been floating around. But, you know, he was a huge top box office draw, and he took the lead role in a musical in which he would have to sing live on the set. And he's not really the best singer in the world, but you know, he mostly pulls it off just by dint of sheer charm, you know?
Right, and that was one thing that you see over and over again in folks who talk about his presence and his career, was that he was having a blast.
Yes.
Right? He just radiated like the joy of being a star. And apparently when he did Boogie Nights, which I think maybe a lot of younger people now know him for,
sure,
the movie that he actually got an Oscar nomination for, apparently he didn't think he was good at it and he didn't like himself in it.
Fascinating.
But then he was bummed that he lost the supporting actor Oscar to Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting.
Oh, that's right. No, I remember he was very disappointed about that because I think that really would have maybe turned things around for his later career. But yeah, like at the apex of his stardom, he was as famous for being a guest on the Johnny Carson show as he was for being a movie star. And he just, yeah, just was, you know, had a big laugh and really kind of dug it. And sort of like Adam Sandler, he had this kind of like ensemble that he would carry around with him. People like Dom DeLuise, you know, Charles Nelson Reilly, strangely enough, was sort of part of his orbit. I think he directed quite a few shows at the Burt Reynolds Dinner Theater in Jupiter, Florida. Yeah, so just, you know, had the famous romances with Dinah Shore and Sally Field. He was married to Lonnie Anderson. They had a rather contentious divorce, as I recall.
How 70s is that? The idea of Burt Reynolds and Lonnie Anderson. Like, they both just epitomize
Indeed.
A certain look and a certain vibe of that era.
Yes, for sure. You know, and he actually directed quite a few films, and I think some of them were good, like Paternity and Sharky's Machine. He fills this interesting role because he's very much sort of past the era of like what we consider sort of golden age Hollywood, you know, the studio system and the MGM stars or whatever. And while he's very much an essential part of 70s cinema, we don't think of him as being part of the, like, you know, Easy Riders and Raging Bulls generation. You know, he didn't work with Scorsese and Spielberg and, you know, Hal Ashby, who we'll be talking about later. But, you know, was making very successful films in that era. In fact, I think the movie Best Friends was made mainly because he had been, in the previous year, he had been the top male box office draw, and Goldie Hawn had been the top female box office draw. So I was like, well, let's put these two together then. You know, like, that was literally why that movie got made.
It's an algorithm.
Totally, yes.
So, yeah, so very sad. Burt Reynolds at 82 is gone. Go back and watch a Burt Reynolds film, or just look at a poster of him. let his glorious furry manliness just overtake you.
Yes, swoon.
Yes, so also, Alonzo just got back from the Venice Film Festival, as I mentioned off the top, and I'd love to hear how it went. What was the best thing you saw? Just tell me all about the greatness of it.
You know, I mean, it's always a terrific event, and it's the kind of thing where, like with any sort of big film festival like Sundance or wherever, you one person can't take it all in, you know. Like, I could go to Venice and see nothing but, like, VR, you know, or nothing but, like, short films or you know, small first-time features out of Eastern Europe, or, you know, they've got all kinds of parallel tracks happening at the festival. The festival itself funds three low-budget features every year that then premiere at the festival. I think it's called the Biennale College. But, you know, I'm there for the rap, so I'm there to see the big movies, and so I go to the big movies. So this year, you know, they opened with First Man, the new Damien Chazelle film about Neil Armstrong, starring Ryan Gosling, and that played really well. And then almost immediately somehow got hijacked into some ridiculous non-story about whether or not they show the flag on the moon.
I was going to ask you, were there enough American flags in First Man?
You know what? It didn't even cross my mind as I was watching it. And then when it became a topic of conversation later, people kept asking me, well, do you see the flag? I'm like, I don't know.
Right.
By the time they asked me that, I'd seen seven other films in the meantime. Like, I don't remember if you see the flag or not. Who cares?
None of which also had American flags in them, right?
They did not, no, strangely enough. But I mean, you know, the whole movie, though, is such a celebration of, and I think you can't make a movie about that era without at least backhandedly kind of celebrating the fact that we put a man on the moon, you know, we mankind, but also we, the United States government and its taxpayers, you know, we had the science and we had the technology and we had the wherewithal and the manpower and all the things, you know, to make that thing happen. So, you know, show me a flag or not, it doesn't matter. Like, you're still celebrating, you know, this era of American ingenuity and progress and can-doism, you know, by just telling the story in the first place. But it's a really well-done film. There were several films this year that I thought it was interesting in terms of perspective. Like, you were seeing something in a movie where you hadn't seen it from that, like, angle before, or you didn't feel it in the way that, or you felt it in a way that you hadn't felt it before. Like, for example, with First Man, you know, he goes up in the Gemini mission, and, you know, it's this tiny capsule, and you can just hear the rivets straining and the metal groaning as it's, like, shooting out into orbit, and it's terrifying, and I don't think I'd ever really felt a space launch in a movie that way before, not even in, like, Apollo 13 or The Right Stuff. Just the idea of, like, I'm inside this machine that was built by me and other men, and, you know, like, we're mortals and we're subject to mistakes, and, like, I'm just taking a risk here. This is going to work. You know, I felt the same way with with A Star Is Born, there's a scene early on where, you know, Bradley Cooper's character is performing in front of like a giant, you know, outdoor arena or whatever. And it's one of the few movies where I feel like it the sound captures what a rock concert must sound like if you're on stage as opposed to in the audience. You know, it's a subtle difference, but I really noticed. Of course, they showed it to us at Dolby. You know, I think they really wanted to make sure that we got the full brunt of the sound mix. But that movie is really quite terrific. I was very pleasantly surprised. I had no idea how that was going to go because, you know, this is the fourth Star Is Born movie, fifth if you count What Price Hollywood. And, you know, he's never directed before. She's never had to be a lead actress before. But it all comes together really quite well. The songs are good. They have really good chemistry. You know, they update the story in very smart ways in terms of, you know, there are certain plot beats you just know you're going to get in a Star Is Born movie, but they don't entirely, you know, hit expectations. So that was really good. I like that one a lot.
I recall you being a tad skeptical about by director Bradley
Cooper. Director Bradley Cooper. Yeah, the trailer was laying that on a bit thick. No, I don't know how much of it is like he's a genius or he just hired a good DP and is good with actors. You know, whatever it is, it all comes together really well.
And Gaga is good.
She is good. She takes you on a journey, you know, and that character goes through a lot of changes. And I'll tell you, I think this movie does really well that a lot of movies about music don't do well is when they had to start with a finished song and then they have to break it into pieces so you can watch the characters write it. And that can be the phoniest thing in the world. Like I always remember Britney Spears in Crossroads.
Aww.
I'm not a girl. What
also,
comes next?
I'm not yet a woman.
Yeah, exactly. Like that could be a super phony scene. And in this movie, they do it really effectively. It feels organic. And I guess because she's a songwriter, maybe that helped. But, so yeah, it does a lot right. I wanted the ending to blow me away more and just like leave me emotionally shattered, and it didn't quite do it. But other people who saw the film thought I was nuts for saying so, and that they were weeping at the end.
Right.
So
all the awards hype is justified then. You would
yeah.
Say.
So I'm going to watch it again though, for sure. But yeah, no, for absolutely. I think it's a very, you know, it's a really promising debut for him, for her. You know, I think people are really going to respond to it.
Okay. So those are the two best things you saw? Which are the two most high profile?
I would say so. I mean, like I thought Roma was terrific.
It looks amazingly beautiful.
It's so gorgeous and so it's so subtle, but it's so powerful at the same time. And it's a Netflix movie, but I very, very highly recommend that you see it projected if you can.
And that was the case as well with Mudbound, you know, which I know we're not giant fans of it, but it's a movie that is gorgeous and you need to see
on
the screen.
The cinematography is one of the best things about Mudbound, so for sure, yeah. And in this one, you know, it was shot on 65 digital. I don't know what that means exactly.
And Alfonso Cuarón shot it.
Alfonso Cuarón shot it, and it's just breathtaking. Beautiful black and white. And just such a great memory piece. I love when directors make films about their own childhood in a really, you know, thoughtful way. I loved Roma. I loved The Sisters Brothers.
It looks fun.
It's a lot of fun, and it is. I'm not a huge Westerns fan. I mean, like, I could name you a dozen Westerns that you have to see, and you know, I think anybody who loves film, you can't completely blow off any genre, you know, musicals, horror, like you got to find the ones that speak to you. But Westerns has never been the top of my list of go-to, you know, kind of movies to see. And I think this one is a satisfying Western in terms of shootouts and, you know, campfires and wide open spaces and that kind of thing. But it's also kind of it's an interesting character study. And so I think that if you're not a Westerns fan, this might be one that you'll find appealing anyway. It's from director Jacques Audiard, who did A Prophet, based on a novel that I had never heard of. But since seeing the film, and I've been talking about it to people, I've heard so many people say, oh my God, I love that book. So I guess
the book is also called The Sisters,
Brothers, yeah,
because they are brothers whose last name is Sisters.
That is correct.
and it's Joaquin Phoenix and John C. Reilly.
Yes,
right?
And John C. Reilly, this is a really great role for him. Like I in my review for The Wrap, I said that it felt like he got to use more of his comic and dramatic, you know, abilities side by side more than in any film maybe since Magnolia. So I wouldn't be surprised if he becomes part of the Oscar conversation. I can't wait to see what you think about the new Yorgos Lanthimos, Favourite.
Did you love it?
I loved it.
I bet I will too, because I really love him. And I love all those actresses. And I'm so happy to see Olivia Colman getting a bigger, meatier role than she often gets. Or at least a meaty role on a larger stage.
Yes.
Because she's been so great in smaller stuff for so long. So for the world to finally see
exactly.
that Olivia Colman is great, it's about time.
Right. Like, yeah, maybe you didn't see Tyrannosaur, but you'll probably see this one. You know, it's interesting because I try not to be. I'm not an awards pundit, and I don't like to think about that stuff. But watching, I was thinking, oh, this is a nomination here. But I thought this is a supporting nomination. Right. But what I'm hearing is they're going to put her up in lead. So I don't know if that's going to be good or bad for her. But yeah, I've been a fan of Olivia Colman since, you know, season two of Look Around You. So, you know, I'm excited for her. I was kind of mixed on the new Coen Brothers project. It's a Western anthology called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, also for Netflix. And it's sort of six, you know, different vignettes within the film. And like any anthology film, they kind of run hot and cold. And none of them are terrible, but the best one is the first one.
So it's kind of downhill from there.
And, you know, and when you know it's vignettes, you know, if you sort of lose interest in one, you're kind of thinking like, all right, well, let's just get this one over with and we can move on to the next one, you know. But it's fine. And I think, you know, it's a decidedly minor work from them, but fans will enjoy it. And there's some fun performances in there. And I really hated Suspiria, but yes, I
don't want to know that.
I know, but it has become people are already calling it this year's Mother in terms of its divisiveness.
Right.
Like, I think currently on Rotten Tomatoes, it has 8 fresh and 9 rotten. Like, it's going to be very 50-50 probably as the year goes out.
Well, not that I don't trust you, because I absolutely do. Mm-hmm. However, the people who really love it, I kind of trust, like Tim Grierson. And like,
no, I guess you've got some difficult choices to make, Christy, don't you?
No, but people who I'm usually aligned with,
sure,
are not necessarily always aligned.
This is true.
Wise.
But I love Luca Guadagnino. I'm a huge fan. Like, I have taught I Am Love to grad mm-hmm. students, and I just think this is a hot mess.
It is an interesting hot mess.
No. For the first third, I thought they were doing some interesting things, but by the end of it, I was bored out of my mind, and I felt like it was sort of raising all of this sort of political subtext, but not delivering on it. You know, it's like, okay, yeah, it's Germany in 1977, which is where the first film is set. So we're going to talk about Bader-Meinhof, and we're going to talk about residual guilt from the Nazis and all that stuff. And I was like, okay. And then there's no and, you know, so I don't know. I will be curious to hear what you think.
And it's very long, right? It's like an hour longer than the original?
Yeah, it's like 2.5 hours. It is longer than the new Frederick Wiseman movie, which sadly screened the day I left and I didn't get to see it yet.
Wow, that was like a short Frederick Wiseman movie. It's not 12 hours long.
Yeah, it's a mere like, you know, 2:40 or something.
And then what was the best flavor of gelato that you ate?
You know, I really like stracciatella, which is sort of like chocolate chip, but the chocolate is more flaked. It's kind of, it's more subtle, but it's still there throughout. But yeah, I had a lot of really good gelato.
And if you're interested in seeing the gelato that Alonzo ate, there are photos of it on the Linoleum Knife Instagram feed.
It's true, at Linoleum Cast. Go check it out.
So go check it out. Awesome. So while you are in Venice and Ben's at Telluride and everyone's seeing all these really good awards worthy movies, it's still early September here on planet Earth
at sea level.
And so we have movies like Peppermint. Alonzo and I saw Peppermint last night. Do you want to describe it?
Oh, sure. it's from the director of Taken. So, you know, that means it's got competent action and a vague hint of racism. Jennifer Garner stars as a wife and mother whose husband and daughter are murdered by a drug-dealing gang of Mexican-Americans. When she cannot find justice through traditional means because everyone is afraid of this powerful drug dealer, she goes off the grid and surfaces 5 years later as a gun-toting martial arts badass who is out to pick off everyone who was involved in denying her justice for her family's death. And I was, as much as I would have loved to see the Batmom Returns version of this movie, where it's just about her going to Asia for 5 years and learning how to shoot guns and kickbox, we kind of skip over that part and just get to the vengeance, and that's sort of boring.
No, they completely skip over that part. Yeah. And that is probably, as you say, the most interesting part. Like, in the beginning of the movie, she's just normal San Fernando Valley mom and
works
wife.
Works in a bank.
Works in a bank and has, like, really... like tasteful hair, and she takes her daughter, who's like maybe 9 or 10 years old, to sell her Girl Scout cookies at the grocery store. Like, right. They take pains to depict her as like as mundane yeah. as possible, and then the transformation is so vast, it is so severe, and it's alluded to in this like long expository scene in the FBI,
yeah, like with a PowerPoint presentation
where they show her various like. Passports under aliases and like surveillance video of her stealing like high tech weaponry or whatever,
or being in an underground kickboxing tournament.
That was hilarious. and the thing is, it's so cursory that this transformation that was meant to be kind of like stunning
yeah.
ends up being kind of unintentionally funny.
Yeah, because it's like, you know, you could have really leaned into that and cast someone that we don't even think of as being an action person. But like Jennifer Garner, I think maybe they just thought, well, we know that she's Alias and she was Elektra for a hot minute, so we'll just bring that baggage with us, and so we won't need to see the transformation. But no, it's a pretty severe one from twin sets to like, you know, Kevlar.
This looks super cute with purple. Yeah, no, and I had not high hopes, but like adequate hopes.
Trashy hopes.
Yeah, for like Jennifer Garner's Taken, right?
Yeah.
Because Pierre Morel directed Taken.
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer Garner is a little too young for a Taken. You know, she's not at the point in her career, or she's not the age of Liam Neeson when he had his Liam Neesoning.
She's not Halle Berry in Kidnap.
Yeah, no, but I like the idea of somebody who you don't necessarily always think of anymore as an action star.
Sure.
And you know, she's doing commercials for Capital One at this point.
I kept yelling, "What's in your wallet?" during the movie, or within my head anyway.
It's an explosive device. You'll never see it coming. Yeah, you mentioned the vague whiff of racism. I would argue that it's even more than a vague
it's
whiff.
It's a stench. Yeah.
Like every single person in this who is bad is Mexican, but like also with face tat and like the buttoned up flannel shirt.
Yeah, it's very like the MS-13 central casting. I mean, they hedge their bets a little by making like all of the evil powerful people white, like the judge and the district attorney, and then all the cops who aren't dirty are people of color. So you've got like John Ortiz, you've got the woman who plays the FBI agent, you've got Method Man as one of the cops, you know. So like they're trying desperately to hedge their bets. But yeah, this is mostly, oh look, the scary Mexicans, they have automatic weapons and they're going to shoot your adorable daughter.
Yeah, and in theory, I should be into this kind of movie, right? I mean,
sure.
As a wife and mom myself in LA, I should at least relate to her journey or her instinct, but it's so over the top and in the name of just cheap thrills and like visceral, bloody excitement
yeah.
that it really obliterates whatever the underlying emotional driving force is behind this killing spree. And then some of the killings are so over the top that I was distracted. I'm like, okay, how did she lug all three of these bodies
to the Ferris wheel?
To like a really high part of the Ferris wheel, too. Or did she like? Did she string them up down the bottom?
And then
like,
she turned it at 45 degrees.
Lay like, flat. Yeah. Did she lay them flat and like tie their legs together and then tie them to one of the poles on the Ferris wheel and then crank up the Ferris wheel? Like, how does she know how to operate a Ferris wheel? Was there one?
She learned in Asia.
I was going to say. Along with kickboxing. Or does she know how to run a Ferris wheel from her days as the Girl Scout mom? You know? I want to know. And so I found a lot of the details of this very distracting.
Yeah, there's a moment when they figure out the reason that crime has gone down in Skid Row where she's been hiding out is because of her. Because there's this enormous mural of like her as depicted as an angel with wings made out of guns and a hoodie. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me.
And the thing is, as you say, it's giant. The mural is giant. So they're on the lookout for this person. How did they never notice a mural of her across the street from the beat up van she lives in.
It might as well be a billboard that
like,
says,
"Hi, I live here."
Exactly.
Come on over, and my van is unlocked because I trust all of these vagrants and homeless people. Anyway, so yeah, it's distracting. It's really September.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
So what is your number then?
Oh, golly. What did I even say?
You said 2.5.
2.5. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, like, Garner commits to it, then it's nice to see her, you know, kicking some butt again. But this is a rock stupid movie.
I'm saying 3. I don't know why. So our number is a 2.8. And it's at 9%.
Ouch.
On the tomato meter. So there's, like, a person who feels vaguely good about it enough to give it a vaguely fresh review.
I mean, I suppose if you're in the right mood for the right kind of action cartoon, you know, maybe, but...
But it's not even cartoony. It's just like, it's just bloody. It's just like nonstop carnage. And again, I'm not offended by that. And if it's done in a stylish way, like Atomic Blonde was on the other day and Chris had never seen it. So we just like sat there and I got totally sucked into it again. And was thinking about you with all the problems you have with the various song choices.
Yeah.
Like they would not be playing the politics of dancing at that disco
underground
in
club,
Berlin.
Yeah.
But I got totally into that. And again, like if the violence, if the badass female ass kicking is done in a stylish way, you know, and with well-drawn characters and it's well-acted and all that, I'm good. This is just empty.
Yeah.
Empty early September carnage.
Afraid so.
So also coming out this week is The Nun.
Tell me. I haven't seen it yet.
Which you managed to miss because you were just coming back into town, and that's fine. So this is the prequel to the Conjureverse, right? So there were the Conjuring movies that James Wan did, and then there were the Annabelle movies, which were prequels to the Conjuring movies.
Right.
And then now we have The Nun, and The Nun is the image of the creepy nun that we see appearing in various films in the previous Conjuring universe.
In Conjuring 2,
Conjuring
2.
Yeah. But I feel like elsewhere also. I feel like someplace
maybe in Annabelle Creation?
Else, maybe.
I can't remember.
I don't remember. But she's seen as like a painting, like a drawing, like an image on a wall. Mm. And it's, you know, the chalky white skin and the cheekbones jutting out. And the glowing yellow eyes and the bloody fangs for teeth. And it's like, it's a creepy image. The idea that somebody who should be holy and pure and protective is actually demonic is kind
Dominica,
of a...
Nica, Nica.
Yeah, it's an evil, kind of scary idea, theoretically.
Right.
But as I wrote in my review for RogerEbert.com, The Nun reminded me of the Minions.
Explain.
Because the Minions in the Despicable Me movies, a little bit of them goes a long way, right? Like they're quite powerful in their little bursts of insanity with their little overalls on, and you know they try to get things right and they mess up, and that's kind of fun. The Nun, like the quick blast of the image of the nun in the Conjuring previously, like that's good for a scare. Here it's a whole movie about the nun. They're trying to explain how it is that the nun became the nun.
So it's like trying to say boo for 90 minutes.
it actually, you know, they try to set up the same kind of scare over and over again. So it takes place in 1952 in Romania at this abbey that is still kind of reeling from being bombed during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
There is a young nun who hangs herself at the beginning of the film. She has seen something deeply frightening. She and another nun go down a dark hallway. It's very like old school gothic horror, like crypts and catacombs and like dark hallways that are candlelit and, you know, creaky doors and all that. So she and a fellow nun see something that is terrifying, and she realizes that her only way to not become a vessel for this evil is to kill herself. And so she hangs herself, and that of course is incredibly sad, but it's also a sin. And so the Vatican sends a priest, played by Demian Bashir, who is a notorious demon hunter, and a young nun on the verge of taking her final vows, a novitiate, played by Thaisa Farmiga, and sends them because she has seen visions.
Mm.
People thought she was crazy, but maybe not. Maybe she's just blessed with the seer. And that's a nice bit of casting in that Thaisa Farmiga is Vera Farmiga's younger sister. I thought at first that maybe this was going to be the same character.
Well, I was going to say, Bibbs in his review said, like, you keep thinking that the reveal is going to be that Irene is Lorraine, but apparently, no.
No, it's just a nice little bit of casting in that, you know, Lorraine also is a seer, a supernatural seer.
But he said it's like if a DC superhero movie had a character named Mark Kent and then never commented on it.
I kept waiting, but it didn't happen. Anyway, so she has a kind of a lovely, similarly steely, quiet, powerful presence about her, like her sister. So they go to the convent to try to investigate. They try to interrogate or interview the surviving nuns, and the nun, capital the nun, is still kind of lurking the hallways. And Demi Bashir and Thaisa Farmiga keep trying to do their job, and they keep spinning their wheels. It's like the Sisyphean task. Like they get stuck behind this giant metal gate that come down at some moment in time every night. So they get stuck in one part of the castle, or the sisters have taken their vow of silence for the evening and they can't speak till the sun comes up the next day. And so they can't, you know, anyway. And so we're kind of stuck spinning our wheels too. We're like, all right, whatever. So what's going to happen here? The place is dotted with these makeshift wooden crosses all over the grounds. The grounds are all kind of overgrown and creepy, and fog and shrouds everything. And it's very moody. But yes, as I was saying earlier, like the same kind of jump scare comes over and over again. You'll see a nun kneeling in prayer, and all you see is her from the back, you know, like just a mass of black fabric. And you don't know if we see from the side or when we turn around, if it's going to be A, the nun,
right,
or B, like just another nun who's now been possessed by this evil that is haunting this place. And so you kind of get ready for it. Like it's kind of predictable and not as much fun as it's trying to be. There are some solid scares here. It's more of like a crazy kind of gothic thrill ride versus what I really liked about the initial Conjuring films was that there's a legitimate emotional underpinning to them, right?
Yeah.
And you really come to care about what Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga and the journey they go on with these people.
Well, and they firmly go out of their way to set them in like a recognizable real world, whereas this sounds like spooky Eastern European castle. Ooh, yeah.
It is very much that. And they have a lot of fun with things that maybe aren't what you think they are. Anyway, there's also a hunky French-Canadian farmhand who is their guide and provides some comic relief for them and is kind of flirty and like flirts with Thaisa Farmiga, whatever. It is okay. It's just kind of like an empty exercise. And disappointing in that. Okay, so the first two Conjurings were good. The first Annabelle sucked.
Right.
And then the second Annabelle was pretty good.
It was pretty good, yeah.
This is a step back again.
But still better than the first Annabelle.
Still better than the first Annabelle, okay. Yeah. And it's repeatedly, and then once you get full frontal nun, because you get kind of, you get glimpses of her in the darkness and the hallways. Once you get full frontal nun, like, all right, we get it. She's scary looking.
And she's in it.
Yeah, but what she wants beyond just like run-of-the-mill possession isn't really all that clear and not all that compelling.
Her agenda is not...
She's just trying to... And then it becomes, then they have to go investigate in the catacombs. They have this key, this really weird, like jagged metal key, and they've got to figure out what it opens, and they have to go down through this hidden door, and it becomes almost like Da Vinci Code light, which is redundant, I realize. So it becomes kind of a whole different, like, Indiana Jones, Da Vinci Code kind of action-adventure movie.
Right.
Anyway, it's just...
The Mummy.
It's not good. It's from director Corin Hardy. It was written by the guy who wrote the first Annabelle and also It.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's not very good. So I'm saying it's okay. It's got atmospherics. It's kind of empty.
Sure.
5.4 is my number.
Okay.
It is at 41% right now on the tomato meter. I gave it 2 stars on my review for RogerEbert.com. So that would also be a miss, it seems. But there's a really good movie this week coming out. It's coming out in New York this week, and then L.A. at least next week, and opening from there, I would assume, and that is Hal. It's a documentary about Hal Ashby.
Yes. Hal Ashby is doesn't always get mentioned when we talk about sort of the great maverick filmmakers of the 70s, you know, Scorsese and Coppola and that whole crowd. But he had a string of films that have been... that have continued to have really great influence and resonance in among the next generation of filmmakers. You know, he started off as an editor. He won an Oscar for editing In the Heat of the Night. And then after working for years with director Norman Jewison on several films, Jewison sort of gave him the opportunity to direct The Landlord. And then from there, he made Harold and Maude and The Last Detail and Shampoo and Being There. And, you know, just really kind of carved out this place for himself as this great kind of humanist filmmaker and, you know, was an interesting character himself, had several marriages. We come to find out about his whole pre-Hollywood life and the family that he left behind to move west from Ogden, Utah, where he was from, his sort of ignominious end to his career where, you know, in the 80s, the movies weren't as good, and partially because of studio interference, maybe partially because of his, you know, cocaine addiction, and you know, it's really kind of a celebration of his career and this sort of, you know, this these amazing films that he left behind and their sort of ongoing influence on filmmakers like Wes Anderson, who's not in the film, but they do talk to, you know, Alexander Payne and David O. Russell and Lisa Cholodenko and Allison Anders and Judd Apatow and Adam McKay. So it's, you know, you're not, almost nobody has anything bad to say about Hal Ashby. This is a movie that's very kind of fawning in a way. But, you know, a lot of actors that worked with him talked, like Jane Fonda and John Voight and Jeff and Beau Bridges.
Rosanna Arquette.
So, yeah, it's, you know, it's a lovely little film and kind of a reminder of a director that we don't talk about enough, even though we do talk about his movies a lot.
And even the vaguely negative things that are said in here are still said through the general theme of this is somebody who cared really deeply.
Yes.
And took great care and was very protective of his work. And so if there are, you know, reminiscences about him taking a long time to make something or, you know, shooting a lot of footage or whatever, it's always through the
he did it for the right reasons.
The anecdotal example of him, you know, caring too much. Yeah, I did not know all that much about his life. I mean, certainly I've seen of those seven really important films.
Oh, Bound for Glory. I forgot about
that. And Coming Home.
And, oh, right. Did I not say that? Yes, no. Coming Home. Sorry.
Yeah, so Coming Home earns Oscars for the screenplay and for Jane Fonda and for John Voight. Yeah, I did not know that much about his personal life, but they kind of also skim over a lot of his personal life. I mean, it really is, it's about the work and about what an exciting collaborator he could be, what like hugely charismatic and kind of like an eccentric friend he was. There are some very funny letters between him and Norman Jewison,
yes,
which Ben Foster narrates the letters. It's very funny. And, you know, he types them out in a typewriter. And
some great, like, audio recordings of Ashby as well. I don't know where those came from, but he kind of talks about his sort of philosophy behind filmmaking and stuff that really kind of punches things up as well.
Yeah, and it makes you appreciate, especially, you know, especially now, but he's very of his time in terms of coming up during the Vietnam War, coming up during the Civil Rights Movement, and how important those themes of equality and civil rights
and peace
and just decency. Yeah, when he wins his Oscar for editing In the Heat of the Night, he says, I hope we can all use our talents for the, you know, the ultimate goal of peace and love, you know,
right.
And that's the entirety of his speech. It's what he's saying, he was saying, you know, 50 years ago is still incredibly resonant and relevant today. So hopefully this will, it will expose people to Hal Ashby who maybe did not know his work. I think if you knew him and loved him anyway, this will completely reaffirm what you already knew and loved. And if you are younger and interested in film or just did not know that much about Hal Ashby, this is very compelling and lively and short. Amy Scott directed and edited this, and I think Hal Ashby himself would very much appreciate how briskly it moves.
It is. It's very well edited.
This is her first film.
Oh, wow.
She's been an editor for a while, like 15 years now, and this is her first film, but I think it's a great kind of nice touch and a nice homage that somebody who comes from an editing background wants to shine a light on Hal Ashby. Yeah, some great, great anecdotes, and just what a totally different time it was in Hollywood. We were talking about Burt Reynolds earlier on the show. This is also, you know, so evocative of that era where, you know, big ideas could get through, and, you know, personalities that shook things up could get through.
Yeah, I would definitely. This is a movie I would recommend to people who want to be filmmakers, just in terms of the idea of how to deal with. Like, what does the director want versus what does the studio want, you know? And about, you know, he has this great quote about, like, why would you aim for the middle of the road? You know, like, aim for the, go as big as you want. Go make, try and make it exactly the way you want to, because inevitably there will be compromises along the way. There's going to be, you may not hit everything that you want to do, but if you start already aiming for the middle, then you're already going to be less than that, you know?
Yeah. Focusing on the work and on his approach and on his philosophy is totally compelling. I would have liked to have known a little more about his personal life. I mean,
sure.
they reference the fact that he's a ladies' man and the people he had been involved with, but he was married 5 times.
Yeah.
We hear from his daughter from his first marriage, from when he was still in Utah before he even left for Los Angeles to make movies. I would have liked to have seen that element of this really fascinating guy's complex personality fleshed out.
Yeah, there are some dots that don't get connected. But in terms of just talking about, like, the great films that he made, they really do kind of go deep. And you get, you know, like I said, Jane Fonda and people talking about working on those films and how they got made and what he brought to the table and what his ideas were. And for that alone, it's fascinating.
What is your favorite Hal Ashby film?
Probably Harold and Maude, just because that movie meant so much to me when I was in high school. I saw it so many times, and like I hear those Cat Stevens songs, and I'm immediately, he's in the film as well, by the way. I'm just immediately sort of transported. But you know, obviously, Coming Home is really powerful. Being There is a brilliant movie,
and so relevant now.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, Judd Apatow calls it a perfect film. I need to see Shampoo again because I think maybe I was too young when I saw it and I didn't get it. And I've never seen The Landlord or Bound for Glory.
I've never seen The Landlord, The Last Detail, or Bound for Glory.
Oh, I haven't seen The Last Detail either. Yeah,
I want to catch up with those. Yeah.
Although we did see whatever that Richard Linklater sort of kind of sequel last year was.
Oh,
remember?
That is what that was. What
yeah.
Was, yes.
They changed the names of the characters, but basically that was a sequel to The Last Detail.
Oh, yes.
It says Flag Brother.
I'm going to look it up. I'm going to look it up while we're sitting here because I have my laptop.
But I remember like watching, like, okay, so Steve Carell is Randy Quaid, and Walter White is Jack Nicholson. Why am I blanking
Bryan
on his
Cranston.
Name? Bryan Cranston, thank you. And Lawrence Fishburne is the other guy.
Last Flag Flying.
I knew Flagger Brother was in the title.
Yes, it is Bryan Cranston, Steve Carell, and Lawrence
Fishburne.
Yes. You know, I totally spaced that was sort of a follow-up to that. That's interesting. Yeah, I also would say Harold and Maude because it's so unique and so singular, and that balance he finds in the tone between just like the dark and the macabre and the twisted and just the light, sweet purity of their relationship. And the music is perfect. Yeah, one thing that's interesting that comes out of this is Cat Stevens, Yusuf Salam saying that these were the rough demos. And you can't imagine anything but that kind of intimate, stripped-down music going with
this film. Like they seem so perfect. Like the idea that he didn't feel like those songs were finished yet, you know, which is why you couldn't get them for a long time. Like there was never a soundtrack. It wasn't until I think Cat Stevens' Greatest Hits Volume 2 that you could finally get like Trouble and If You Want to Sing Out and all those amazing songs.
Yeah. Anyway, it's really cool. So please go find it. So I'm saying 8.7 is my number.
I said 8.5.
So 8.6 is our number. We are in sync today, me and Alonzo. And New York this Friday, LA next week, and then hopefully going elsewhere from there. So if you love movies, please go check it out.
And very high on the tomato meter.
Yes. Oh, yeah. 89% on the tomato meter currently as of this recording. Also high on the tomato meter. I wanted to mention real fast, my latest Christie by Request movie happens to be a good one. This is a thing I do on my website where I had people suggest movie titles to me on Twitter, and I put little pieces of paper in a bowl and mixed them all up, and my kid picks one out for me every week.
Oh, that's how you filter out the ones that you've already seen. I always wondered about that.
What's that?
So, like, you take the titles off Twitter, but then if you've already seen the movie, you don't put it in the bowl.
No, I sometimes re-review movies I've already seen.
Oh, interesting.
So, like,
okay.
I did The Lives of Others.
Oh, okay. I thought these were all movies you hadn't seen before.
Oh, no. But sometimes I'll go back and I'll re-watch them, you know, through fresh eyes.
Sure.
Or maybe it's a movie like... So the one that I did this past time around was It Happened One Night, which is a movie I had seen when I was a really little girl and was way too young to appreciate it. So I go and write a review of whatever people have chosen for me to write about. So It Happened One Night is a movie that is, of course, a total classic, massively influential, you know, as screwball comedy, as the, you know, guy meets gal and they hate each other, but they're secretly hot for each other kind of movie. And it was really, really fun to go back and rewatch it. And I had forgotten how racy it was.
Oh, very.
In its day. I mean, beyond just the Claudette Colbert, you know, flashing her leg.
They're sharing a room,
right?
With a blanket.
He's shirtless.
Yes.
Hunky
with
shirtless.
With no undershirt underneath.
Right. What are your memories of It Happened One Night? Frank Capra classic.
That was one that I think I first saw at a rep house in Atlanta when I was a little kid, you know. And... it's one that I've revisited periodically, and yeah, it totally holds up. People think, when they think about Frank Capra, they think that every movie is basically in the vein of It's a Wonderful Life, or Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, or Meet John Doe, or, you know, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, where there's this sort of hokey, small town, you know, American values,
A lesson to be learned.
Exactly, which is a gross simplification of his career. And this is a movie that is just, it is pure comedy, pure, like, great screwball comedy. And Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert have such amazing chemistry, and they're so funny. And there's those, like... The Preston Sturges gets a lot of credit in this department, but Capra also gave you this amazing team of supporting actors who were really funny, you know, so like people like Guy Kibbe and stuff, you know, like the fast-talking guy on the bus, or the guy who plays, you know, Colbert's dad. Like, there's a lot of funny supporting players who come in and out for a couple of scenes. It's interesting because I recently revisited, there are several now year-round Christmas movie podcasts.
And no.
And none of them are hosted by me. But I was a guest on a show called Christmas Creeps, which is very funny. And we watched The Sure Thing.
Oh.
Which is very much, I think, a movie inspired by and modeled after It Happened One Night in a lot of ways. John Cusack and Daphne Zuniga play college students who hate each other and wind up sharing a trip, you know, from coast to coast and fall in love along the way. And, you know, it has become, I think this movie kind of helped create the road trip genre in a way. I'm sure it wasn't the first, but it's sort of the one that kind of cemented it. It was the first film to win the Big Five Oscars. You know, picture, director, screenplay, actor, actress. It's a terrific movie. People should see it.
Very charming, and I also was impressed in watching it, noticing this time, like the little sly bits of absurd humor and like the little lovely grace notes in the midst of all of this, you know, increasingly ratcheting
plot,
up.
Plot. Yeah.
and just the. The tension and the craziness kind of increase as the film goes along. So, you know, he's carrying her over his shoulder. They're crossing a river, and he's carrying her over his shoulder, and she's calling it a piggyback ride. And he's like, this is not a piggyback ride. And they have a whole argument about what exactly is a piggyback ride.
Right.
And he's like, take Abraham Lincoln. Natural born piggybacker. I mean, just random little flights of fancy in the middle of
the scene where he teaches her how to dunk a donut.
That's funny, yeah. And then when he's toward the end, you know, we're reaching the climax. He's trying desperately to get back to her on her wedding day. And he's stuck at a railroad crossing in this convertible that he has stolen. And so he's stuck watching this train go by. And there's a whole car full of these, like, rowdy hobos who are, like, laughing and smiling and waving at him. And it cuts back to him, like, smiling back at them and giving him a little wave. Like, it has the lovely little moments even within the machinery.
When everybody's in a stuck bus and they all sing The Girl in the Flying Trapeze. you're right. There's the little nutty bits. And one of my favorite, like, wedding interruptus scenes in a movie ever, when she takes off running with that, like, cathedral-length train behind her.
And I love the speech that her dad gives her walking down the aisle.
Yes.
Because it's, like, simultaneously pragmatic and romantic. You know, he's telling her in this really even-tempered, like, measured voice, telling her as he's walking her down the aisle not to marry the guy she's about to marry.
Yes.
I like the balancing act of that. It's pretty cool.
No, that is one of the great moments. I actually gave a similar speech like that to a friend of mine dancing with her at her rehearsal dinner. And as it turned out, I was right. She did get divorced a couple years later.
Oh, but she did get married the
next
day.
She did get married the next day. But I was like, my car is outside. We can go. We can go and it'll be, you know.
Wow. Yeah. And then did you say, I told you so? When
I
did.
I would never. No, she told me that I told her so.
Oh, my God. So, anyway, that's a great one. So, that is streamable on Amazon or wherever you want to stream things. It's definitely out there. I'm sure TCM probably shows it all the time.
Yeah, too, it might even be on Filmstruck. I don't know for sure, though.
Yeah, it's out there for your consumption. So, watch it, rewatch it. It's a blast. But really fast. Speaking of Oscars, though. One more quick bit of news we have for you. The Academy Awards will not have this ridiculous most popular category next year.
Miss Congeniality instead.
I'd say, who will play the cello? Not me. So yeah, this was an idea that the Academy came out with about, a month or so ago?
Yeah.
And there was this massive balking by everyone. Like, no one thought it was a good idea to add a most popular category. It just seemed like transparent and a cynical ploy for
ratings,
audience. Yeah. And so now they came out today saying, we're going to take a step back and we're going to rethink it. But they are making the change where they're not going to broadcast
all the awards
live.
Yeah.
Every single award. There's like maybe 6 or 8, you know, technical ones that they're going to give out during the commercials and then cut those winners real fast and then go back to them during the broadcast, which I think is a terribly insulting idea.
The Tonys does that and I hate it, where they'll have like the first part of the award show, and then if you watch the telecast, you just see in the bumpers coming in and out of commercials like a very truncated version of somebody's speech. And it's like, no. Like, one of the cool things about the Academy Awards, and if you are watching the Academy Awards, you ostensibly care about movies to some extent, is that was the moment where like the sound effects editor or the documentary short filmmaker or the costume designer gets their moment on TV to sort of talk about what it is they do and why it matters to them. And I hate that they're going to get relegated off to the sidelines like that. I mean, the Academy has this whole weird history. I mean, Bret Easton Ellis had a fascinating conversation with this on his recent episode with Matt Turnauer, where he talked about how the whole thing was started by Louis B. Mayer as a way to sort of legitimize the movies and as a way to legitimize the people who made movies, because, you know, everybody in the hinterlands just thought, oh, these decadent, you know, Hollywood sinners and their, you know, sybaritic lifestyle. But it's like over the years, I mean, for better or worse, people take the Academy Awards seriously. Mm-hmm. And the Academy itself does a lot of great work. I love their you know, their archives and the grants that they give to people who do, you know, research and who do film preservation and all that stuff. I mean, like, as an organization, they do amazing work. And for whatever reason, like, I think a lot of their annual income comes out of this TV show. And so the fact that the numbers are dropping has them in a bit of a panic. But as has been pointed out, those numbers drop in the way that people who subscribe to cable have dropped. So it's not that fewer people are watching the Oscars, it's that they're watching it at their friend's house who has cable, or they're watching it streaming, or they're watching it in some other way that isn't being tracked by Nielsen.
They're following along on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. But the very wrong thing to do is then to try and pander to this mass audience they think is going to magically tune in if they can somehow manage to, you know, give an award to, I don't know what. And also the idea of, like, most popular, like, the movies that bring nominated for Best Picture aren't already popular somehow.
Well, I mean, you're not seeing, like, the Transformers movies.
Well, because they suck.
Right, they suck. The hugely high-grossing movies aren't necessarily always the ones that get, you know.
I know. This is basically, like, they're just going to keep making us pay for they didn't nominate The Dark Knight. You know, that's what this is about every year, you know. And, like, they didn't nominate Wonder Woman. Now this year, are they going to nominate Black Panther, you know? Right. And it's like,
It's why they expanded the Best Picture race from 5 to potentially 10.
Right, exactly. Yes. And it's like, you know what? Those movies got their award in financial form.
And backpack sales.
Exactly, yeah. You know, and in sequels and in everybody involved getting sweet deals to make more movies. So, like, let Moonlight have its moment, because it was never going to make a gigantic amount of money, but, you know, we could recognize it for its artistry.
Yes. I agree. Well said. Anyway, so we will keep following this debacle of the Oscars trying to figure out what they're doing with themselves.
God.
Anyway, so if you just to recap our reviews for the week, we talked about Peppermint, which is not good. We gave it a 2.8. We talked about The Nun, which also is not all that good. Only I Saw It, and I'm giving it a 5.4. And then there is the Hal Ashby documentary called, appropriately enough, Hal, which is really good, and we gave it an 8.6. So thank you for listening. Thank you for sticking around and sticking with us.
Thank you to everybody on Twitter and Facebook and all the socials who've been so nice about the show. I guess it takes a cancellation sometimes for people to express their true feelings. But we appreciate everybody who reached out to us and asked us if we were coming back and let us know how much they've enjoyed the show over the years. We're not going anywhere. We're finding, you know, we're going to pop up in new places. But, you know, the four of us love working together. We love doing these reviews, and we're going to figure out a way to keep doing it.
Indeed. And thank you to Jonathan Caro, who edited six different
best ofs.
I didn't think we had that much material in us.
Who knew?
But he found it. So I am just overwhelmed by the time that took. So thank you, Jonathan. Thank you to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Bye.